Christian submission. When I say that, you probably have different thoughts running through your head. Thoughts of patriarchy, thoughts of egalitarianism, women's rights, Christian submission. Women are thinking, oh, brother, here we go. All right? But can I say that submission is really simply putting myself under the structured order of God's economy. That Christian submission is what defines what Jesus says, the people who are going to heaven. Look what he says here. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will, submits to the will of my Father who is in heaven. In other words, he says, the submitters go to heaven. That's who gets in. Those who aren't submissive don't. Submission characterizes those who go to heaven. Submission characterizes those that Jesus identifies with himself. He says, whoever does the will of my Father, whoever submits, not to their will, but to my Father's will, those people I identify with in a special way. They're my brothers. They're my sisters. They're my mother. They're the one that I have a familial affection with and for. He connects with us because Jesus Christ was a submitter. He was characterized by submission. Jesus is preaching and he tells the people around him, I have not come down from heaven to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. I've put my will, I've submitted my will, my desires, my goals, my agendas, my glory, my plans to the agenda, the glory, the plans, the will of the one who sent me. Jesus identifies with those who submit because Jesus himself has submitted to the will of the Father. He's put himself in that place of order, of God's economy. In Luke 22, verse 42, you're familiar with this one probably above all others. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. Submission is a big deal. And Jesus shows us exactly what's at stake. It has to come down to this basic. Not what I want, but what you want. And in Jesus, we have somebody whose will was never contrary to the Father. Other than in his own flesh, he didn't want to die. Can't blame him for that. He says, if there's any other way, please. But just a reminder, I want to fit in your ordered economy. I want to be put down so that you can be lifted up. As Jesus is trying to help his disciples understand where they fit in life, how they're doing life, and prayer becoming a part of that shaping of the way they view life, he says, pray like this. Your kingdom come, your will be done right here on earth, just like it's accomplished in heaven. Let us be those who submit to your will. Let us be who fit into your ordered economy. Let us be a part of your kingdom glory, even here on earth as it is in heaven. In fact, submission is what identifies and defines us as Christians when we use that title of our Lord Jesus Christ. Lord, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is what? Lord. What is a Lord? It's a master. What does a master do? He commands and he demands submission. He's the one who says, this is what it's going to be. And it's done. Whoever acknowledges that Jesus is master, that Jesus is Lord, whoever puts their will under the will of the master, they'll be saved. Flip that around. If you don't put yourself under the will of the master, you're not saved. If you don't acknowledge it, remember that first verse we put up there? Many will say to me, Lord, Lord, but they don't do what I command. Those aren't the ones who are going to get in the kingdom. It's the one who call me Lord, and then the ones who treat me as Lord. That's what it means to be saved. Submission is what defines, it's the entry-level posture of Christians. It's the continued posture of Christians. It's who we are as the people of God. One day, everything will submit to Jesus as master. You're familiar with Philippians chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. So at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow of things in heaven, things in earth, things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is master. He's Lord. He's the one whose will must and will be accomplished. That's where it's going. So sometimes when we talk about submission, it's easier for us to look at the opposite. The opposite of submission would be what? Rebellion. Rebellion. So I've entitled this today, A Submission Message for Men and Women. But oftentimes when we hear Christian submission, we think, oh, good, this is going to be, the wives need to fall in line under the male leadership. Guys, this is primarily for us. If you want to be a man of God, then this is what you look like. You look like one who puts yourself into God's ordered economy, putting yourself under the master, the Lord, the leadership of the one who's called you to lovingly lead as he has. Women, it's the same for you. Putting yourself under his ordered economy, following his loving leadership, the one who's called you to lovingly lead in your realm of influence, your sphere of influence. In fact, there's another religion that defines itself by the term submission. In fact, the word Islam or Muslim, Islam is to submit, Muslim is one who submits. It's the very idea of what they view themselves. But the difference is in whom you submit to. Allah of the Muslims has this. He's free to do and choose whatever he wants, and there's no order to it. There's almost a capriciousness. You can never anticipate what Allah is going to do. Our God is different. Our God has a character. He's always the same. Jesus Christ, the same what? Yesterday and today and forever. And so when I come to him in prayer, I know exactly who he is. I know exactly what I'm getting. Now I need to know him more. I need to know him better so that I can trust him more, so I can submit better to his will in my life. But that's what I'm called to do. I'm called to put myself under him. So as we're going to look at today, Korah's rebellion. But the theme isn't primarily rebellion. The theme is submission. And rebellion shows us what submission isn't. And so as we work through this, hopefully, we're going to see that men and women of God must be marked by submission. Korah is not. Dathan is not. Abiram is not. 250 would-be priests are not marked by submission. Let's read this chapter. We'll pray. We did pray. We'll read this chapter and jump in. Number 16. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and An, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took, there's no men there, they took, and rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation, chosen from the assembly, well-known men. They assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron, and said to them, "You have gone too far, for all in the congregation are holy, every one of them. The Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" When Moses heard it, he fell on his face. And he said to Korah and all his company, "In the morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to him. The one whom he chooses he will bring near to him. Do this, take censers, Korah and all his company. put fire in them and put incense on them before the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the Holy One. You have gone too far, sons of Levi. And Moses said to Korah, Hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it too small a thing that to you that the Lord, the God of Israel, has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do service in the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them? And that he has brought you near to him and all your brothers, the sons of Levi, with you. And would you seek the priesthood also? Therefore, it is against the Lord that you and all your company have gathered together. What is Aaron that you have grumbled against him? Verse 12, And Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and they said, We will not come up. Is it a small thing, Moses, that you have brought us up out of the land of milk, flowing with milk and honey, to kill us in the wilderness, that you must also make yourself a prince over us? Moreover, you've not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey. You've not given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. Moses was very angry and said to the Lord, Do not respect their offering. I've not taken one donkey from them. I've not harmed one of them. Moses said to Korah, Be present, you and all your company, before the Lord, you and they, and Aaron, tomorrow. Let every one of you take his censer and put incense on it, and every one of you bring before the Lord his censer. 250 censers, you also and Aaron, each his censer. So every man took his censer and put fire in them, laid incense on them, and stood at the entrance of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Then Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. And the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, Separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. They fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin? And will you be angry with all the congregation? The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Say to the congregation, Get away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, Depart, please, from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing of theirs, lest you be swept away with all their sins. So they got away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents, together with their wives, their sons, and their little ones. And Moses said, Hereby you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, that it has not been of my own accord. If these men die as all men die, or if they are visited by the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates something new, and all the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go alive down into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord. And as soon as he had finished speaking all these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, and they said, Lest the earth swallow us up. And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men offering the incense. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Tell Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, to take the censers out of the blaze, and scatter the fire far and wide, for they have become holy. As for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar. For they offered them before the Lord, and they became holy. Thus they shall be a sign for the people of Israel. So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers, which those who were burned had offered, and they were hammered out as a covering for the altar, to be a reminder to the people of Israel, so that no outsider who is not of the descendants of Aaron should draw near to burn incense before the Lord, lest he become like Korah and his company, as the Lord said to them through Moses. But on the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and against Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." When the congregation had assembled against Moses and against Aaron, they turned toward the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from the midst of this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell on their faces. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer and put fire on it from off the altar. Lay incense on it and carry it quickly to the congregation. Make atonement for them, for wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun." So Aaron took it, as Moses said, and ran into the midst of the assembly. Behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people, and he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped. Now those who died in the plague were 14,700, besides those who died in the affair of Korah. Aaron returned to Moses at the entrance of the tent of meeting when the plague was stopped. It's a pretty graphic chapter as you read the Old Testament. You see this rebellion, which is very on the surface. It's out front. It's not hidden. It's very up front. As we look at this chapter today, I'd like us to kind of look at two features, both of rebellion and of submission. I think it'll help us to understand what Christian submission is and what it's supposed to look like in our lives. The first we're going to look at is the pathway of rebellion. Go back to verse 1. We see there in the ESV it says, "Now Korah," so on and so forth. At the very end of the verse it says, "They took men." Korah took men, and actually it's a singular verb there, focusing on the fact that Korah is the one who is in fact responsible for this taking. But I mentioned as we were reading that the word "men" is not found there in the text. In fact, the word "take" is the very first word of the verse. They took, he took, that is Korah, and Dathan, and Abiram, and On, and 250 others. And the idea of this verb, a verb is transitive when it transfers the action of something and requires an object. We take some thing. So when we use the word "take," we're looking for some sort of object to fill out the taking, because it's a transitive verb. It requires an object that is taken, that we took. But this word "take," it lacks an object. There's nothing there. Most translations insert the word "men." The New American Standard inserts the word "action." They took action. They took men, 250 of them. But this idea of taking, especially as Moses uses it in the Old Testament, in the writing of the Pentateuch, when it's used in this fashion, it often has a negative connotation. Not always. God takes a rib from Adam, and he crafts Eve. So the word "takes" is the word "takes." But often in contexts such as this, where there's a rebellion, the taking kind of highlights the fact that one is taking for oneself what's not been given. So in Genesis chapter 3, Eve reaches out and she takes the forbidden fruit. In Genesis chapter 4, Lamech, rather than taking one wife, takes two wives. In chapter 6, sons of men take all the wives they want, indiscriminately. They're just taking women and adding to their harems. And this idea of taking is the idea of grabbing for myself what doesn't belong to me. It's used again in chapter 12 of Genesis. Pharaoh takes Sarah for his wife. God protects her, but he takes her. Genesis 26, Esau, rather than being concerned about whom his bride should be, he reaches out, he takes Hittite wives, those that weren't his for the taking, but he reaches out and takes them anyway. Next chapter, chapter 27, Jacob reaches out and takes the blessing from Esau, and Esau laments it twice. Says, isn't he a grabber? That's the idea of this verb as it's used here. When we rebel, what we tend to do is we tend to reach out and take for ourselves what isn't given. We think we need something more. We think we deserve something more. And really what's going to happen here, the point of this objectless transitive verb is that this whole scenario, everything that follows, is defined by this sense of grabbing, of taking for myself what God hasn't given. Well, that's not submission. That's rebellion. That's what it looks like when I'm refusing to put myself under. And Korah is then the consummate grabber, the consummate rebeller, the consummate non-submitter. And the thing that characterizes this whole scenario is the fact that he's taking something that is not given to him by God, because he thinks he knows better, because he thinks he needs more, because somehow he's got it better figured out than what God does. That's just the start. But we come to verse 2. And they rose up. They rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel. The idea of rising up is to put oneself forward. Now, Korah apparently was a pretty popular leader. He must have been a distinguished leader in order to enlist the support of 250 men of renown, as the King James says. And they're from other tribes. And Moses addresses them corporately as the sons of Levi, acting as priests. But there's a couple different places where it seems that this may have been broader than just a Levite rebellion, that there were others from other tribes who were, in fact, involved in this. So Korah had gone throughout the tribes, and it says that he chose out men of renown. He chose them out because they were well known, and he brought them to a place where he was their leader, and they were rebelling against the leaders that God had installed. Korah had a popular message. Look what he says there, verse 3. They assembled themselves together against Moses and Aaron, and said to them, "You've gone too far, Moses, because all in the congregation are holy. Who do you think you are? You think you're better than us? Don't you understand?" When we look at the bigger picture here, chapter 15 just closed out with the story of the tassels, right? The command to have tassels on the corners of our garments, the reason being that everyone in the congregation is holy. Everyone in the congregation is a priest king. The whole congregation is that. And so he's building off this and says, "Okay, Moses, who do you think you are to stand in front of the rest of us, whom God has called holy, whom God has called to be a kingdom of priests? Who do you think you are, better than any of the rest of us? Who do you think Aaron is, that he should have this special duty as high priest? You guys are taking something for yourselves that doesn't belong to you." In fact, Korah is the one who's trying to do that. But he says, "Don't you understand? Everybody is good. Everybody is holy. There's a wideness, there's a broadness to this God of ours. And all of us have the same access. Who are you to say what's right, what's wrong for us to do?" And he builds on this idea that the whole company is holy. And honestly, it's right. But Daguid says it this way. Their argument here is a classic case of a false conclusion constructed on a true premise. Is the whole congregation holy? Yes. Does that mean that everybody has the same privileges and the same positions within the community? No. Does that mean there's no positions of priority as far as responsibility goes in God's economy? No. Just because they're holy doesn't mean that they all serve the same function. Just because men and women are both equal at the foot of the cross doesn't mean that they don't have different jobs to do within this economy. And so He says this is a classic case of a false conclusion constructed on a true premise. That high calling on the life of every Israelite did not mean religious egalitarianism, in which everyone had precisely the same status and responsibility. There was still an authority structure set in place by God. They're going outside of their economy to grab something that doesn't belong to them. And Korah does it by putting himself up, but he also does it by putting others down. He says, Moses, you've gone too far. And really what he's challenging there is Moses' greatness. And that's the word that's used there in the Hebrew. You think you're so great. Understand that Korah represents the Levites. The Levites who had been given to the Aaronic priesthood to help them out, to be a part of the job that the priests were supposed to do. They were temple helpers, but they didn't get to do what the priests got to do. But they got to do a lot. But these Levites were always meant to be a support crew. They were never meant to be a challenge. They were never meant to be the ones who would rise up against the priests. Think back to the Garden of Eden, Genesis chapter 3. When God is talking to Adam and Eve, they've sinned. He says, Adam, why did you listen to the voice of your wife above my voice? Why did you give her voice that much authority in your life? Eve, why did you put yourself above your husband and take the leadership rather than following his lead in obedience? And he says, don't you understand? Your desire will now be toward your husband or against your husband. You're going to have this conflict now. There's going to be a competition, a battle of the sexes, if you will, because you've wanted to take the lead, and you're going to continue to want to wrestle that lead from him. That's exactly what's happening here with the Levites. He said, you guys are supposed to work hand in glove. Aaron and the priests and the Levites are supposed to support them, and they weren't ever supposed to be like this. You guys turned this into something that I didn't design. But the only way that Korah can lift himself up is by putting others down. And in front of everybody, he calls out Moses and says, you've gone too far. You make yourself too great. He says, why do you exalt yourself above the assembly of the Lord? End of verse 3. That's an unfair accusation. Brown writes, this is unkind, untrue. These two men had not set themselves over anybody. God had chosen them for their particular ministries. Dad, you're in a position of leadership. Whether it's at a business, whether it's in the home, do you ever sometimes wish that you didn't have the responsibility to lead? Mom, you've got a position of leadership. You ever wish you didn't have the responsibility to lead? You could just be like Peter Pan, never grow up. I'll just live life carefree. I won't connect the dots. I won't have the responsibilities. That's not it. God says, I get to define where you fit in my economy. I'm calling you. I'm calling you and laying on you the responsibility of leadership, of influence within your sphere. You're under some, you're over others. But I'm putting you where I choose to put you. But Korah doesn't like the position that he holds. And so to lift himself out, he starts reaching out and putting others down, rising up before God's people, assembling together against God's program. Verse 3, they assemble themselves together against Moses and against Aaron. You'll find that rebellion never is satisfied to be by itself. You ever found somebody who's a complainer? What do they always try to do? They tell your complaints, hey, Charlie, man, good thing you're sitting over here. Tim really smells bad. I mean, you're just going to want to stay over here. Yeah, see. And then all of a sudden, they start to try to get you on their side, right? And then they're hoping that you'll help to build their message. And then we build this movement against something. That's what a complainer does. Rebellion does the same thing. It's never satisfied to stand up by itself and rebel against the ordered structure of things. It always has to have somebody else to buy into its kingdom, if you will. It's setting itself up in its own particular sphere of influence so that it can be. And that's what happens. They assembled themselves together. Moses, verse 11, says, "Understand, it's against the Lord that you and your company have gathered." Who do you think? Who is Aaron that you're... Aaron's my big brother. He's a great big brother. But it's just Aaron, Korah. In fact, we're going to find out that Korah was actually Moses and Aaron's cousin. He's the firstborn of their dad's brother. So he's about their same age, maybe just a little bit younger. He says, "Korah, you've grown up with us. You know us. Who is Aaron? Aaron's your cousin. He's like your brother, for crying out loud. You're not rising against us. What's eating you is the fact that God has put you in a certain place and he hasn't given you what you wanted, so you are going to rise up and take it." God laid out this order in a very specific way in Numbers chapter 1 through 8. We spent a lot of time. God spent a lot of time in saying, this is where the camps fit. This is where the priests fit. This is where the Levites fit. This is where the Reubenites fit. And he puts everybody in their place, and everybody has a job. Everybody has a position. God set that up. And so as they rebel against this, the rebellion in Numbers 15 is exactly that. It's a frontal assault on the order that God has established. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're rising up not against Moses, not against Aaron. They're rising up against God. Another thing that happens in this pathway of the rebel is that at the end, they end up perishing in judgment at God's hand. And we see how it happens, and we see why it happens. Verse 46, "Wrath has gone out from the Lord." Now here it's specifically a plague. But judgment from God goes out in a dramatic way three different times. In verse 31, it's an earthquake. In verse 35, it's a fire. In verse 46, it's the plague. Each time, it's the wrath of God going out to deal with the rebel community, the rebel individuals. That's what's happening. God's wrath, when finally triggered, is both aggressive and comprehensive. Verse 26, Moses warns them, "Get away from these people, because if you don't, you will be swept away with their sins." God's going to come in like a flood, and he's going to drown you in your perdition, is the idea. We see the very graphic way that it describes what happens in verse 32. "And the ground opened up and swallowed them up." It's interesting. Olson writes, "In the spy story, the rebels claim that the land of Canaan devours its inhabitants, a mythic image that caused the people to rebel against going into the land. But now in chapter 16, what Israel feared in Canaan actually becomes a reality in the desert as the land swallows up the rebels. There's one more word that's used, and it's used repeatedly. Look at verse 35. Verse 35, "Fire came out from the Lord, and it did what? It consumed. It ate up. It swallowed alive. It chewed and spit out. It devoured," is the idea. This consuming presence of God's glory is implied at Sinai. It's a feature of God's glory. His glory burned like a devouring fire on top of the mount, it says in Exodus 24. In Leviticus 10, when Nadab and Abihu offer the strange fire on the altar, we see that this consuming fire comes out and consumes them. This presence of God reaches out and consumes them with fire, and it's demonstrating a feature of God's holiness. He says, "Listen, you do not treat me as one who's ordinary, as one who's profane, as one who's common. I will be treated holy by those who approach me." This consuming presence of God, it's a feature of his glory. It's a feature of his holiness. It's a feature of his jealousy. As Moses is bringing in the second generation, in Deuteronomy chapter 4, he says, understand, your God is a consuming fire. He's a jealous God. And if you give your love and affection and attentions to other gods and put them in prize of place over him, he will consume you because he is a jealous God, jealous for his glory, jealous for his love, jealous for your love for him. And we see in Deuteronomy chapter 9 that this consuming glory of God is a feature of God's protective presence. That it's both a threat and a blessing. And so he says, get ready to go in. The Anak, the giants that everybody's so afraid of. You know who's going in front of you? It's God, who's a consuming fire. He'll eat them up in front of you. You got nothing to worry about. But the pathway of the rebel is one who takes for himself what isn't given, who raises himself up before God's people by lifting himself up and putting others down, who assembles against God's program to work against the structured order that God has instilled. And then the only thing that God can do that is bring judgment. Because it's sticking your fist in God's face and saying, no. So that's the pathway of the rebel, the profile of a rebel. I'm going to move through these just a little quicker. The profile of a rebel, it's interesting, but we see in verse 1, it's Korah. Korah is one who's blessed, but he's not grateful. Korah, we mentioned, is Moses' cousin. He's a Kohathite. Apparently, he's the eldest. He's listed first. He's responsible for the tabernacle furniture. He's the one who gets to wrap up the Ark of the Covenant. He's the one who gets to wrap up and carry the lampstand. He's the one who gets to carry the table of showbread. He's the one who gets to carry the altar of incense. He's the one who gets to carry that curtain that divides the Holy of Holies from the holy place. The Kohathites have been given a huge responsibility. Nobody else in camp can touch what they get to touch. Nobody else in camp is considered as separated, as segregated, as holy as they are, except the priests. He's been given all this privilege, all this responsibility. But it's not enough. So verse 9, Moses says, really, Korah, is it too small a thing for you? Is what God's given you too little? The one who is the God of Israel, who separated you from the congregation of Israel? He separated you to bring you near himself. He separated you to do service inside the tabernacle of God. He separated you to stand before the congregation, the entire congregation, to minister for him. Really, Korah, that's too little for you? What God's given you is not enough? Really? Be careful. Because when we aren't grateful for the blessings that God gives us, we're setting ourselves up as prime candidates to be one who rebels. Because when I don't have enough, what am I going to do? I'm going to grab what's not been given. That's the whole point. Who's another prime candidate? Those who are disciplined but not teachable. Those who are disciplined but not teachable. The 250 chiefs in verse 2, it says they were chosen. They were probably selected by Korah. They were well known. That is, they had influence with others. And they're the ones who are trying to reach out and take their a position that wasn't theirs. But as far as being disciplined, that really refers to Dathan and Abiram in verse 1. They weren't necessarily Levites. In fact, it says they were Reubenites. They're wandering around in the middle of the desert, and they're blaming Moses because they're disappointed. They're disappointed with where life has them. Look at verse 13. Verse 13, it says, is it a small thing, using Moses' own words and slapping him in the face with, oh, Moses, is it a small thing to you? that you've brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey, that is Egypt, to kill us here in this wilderness, that you must make yourself a prince over us? Moreover, you've not brought us to a land flowing with milk and honey. You've not given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? The idea is, do you think we can't see what you're trying to do, trying to make yourself a prince? Don't you think we can see what you're trying to do? Moses, we're wise to you. They sought not the priesthood, but the blessing. They distort the past and the present. In terms of the blessing, they forget the pains of the past. They forget the land flowing with milk and honey to them refers to Egypt. Are these guys so blind they forget just behind them? It wasn't a land flowing of milk and honey. Alter says, the house of bondage is now represented in the very terms of bounty that have been repeatedly used for the promised land. And as they're spouting off this, their accusation has the ring of Korah's influence to it. Moses, you just want to make yourself a prince over us. You're just trying to take what doesn't belong to you, as I try to take what doesn't belong to me. In terms of responsibility, they forget that they bear the responsibility for their failures. Not Moses. Moses, you didn't bring us to the promised land. I brought you to the promised land, but you're not in the promised land because of whose fault? Not mine. It's yours. God has chastised you. God has disciplined you. God has brought pain to train you. God has a future for you still. It's going to be here in this desert. Nope. They refuse to be trained by the pain because they want what they can't have. They forfeited it at this point. They're not teachable. You know, Daguid makes an interesting point here. The ranks of those rebelling are drawn from the first of the Levites to be counted, the Kohathites, the first of the people to be counted, the Reubenites, and those doing the counting, the leaders of the community. What's particularly striking about this group is that the rebellion does not come from the lowest rungs of Israelite society, but from the highest rungs, the most privileged, the elite, the most blessed. I think that stands as a word of warning to all of us, because I think all of us are blessed, blessed beyond what we recognize sometimes. But it's not enough. We want more. We want what's not been given. Those who are blessed but not grateful. Those who are disciplined but not teachable. Finally, there's those who can see but cannot discern. After Korah, Dathan, Abiram are all consumed, swallowed, the very next day the congregation comes and they start complaining. They start to complain because they say in verse 41, Moses, you killed the people of the Lord. Wait a minute, did Moses kill anybody? Did Moses breathe fire on the guys with their censers? Did Moses rip open the ground so it could swallow? Moses didn't do any of that. Who did it? God did it. God did it. They're blaming Moses for something that God did. They're not even taking God into the equation. It happened right in front of their eyes, but they're writing God out of the equation in the story. Moses had intervened on their behalf. In verse 22, God was going to consume the whole community. And Moses and Aaron get down on their knees and say, God, Korah is responsible for this. Will one man sin and you strike the whole crew? God, please have mercy on these people. And he does. He says, okay, tell them to get away. They do. He swallows the ones who are at fault. Now they come and say, Moses, you killed them. Wait a minute. I don't command that kind of authority. I don't have that kind of power. I was protecting you. Now you're accusing me? And even as they're speaking, the Lord begins to send a plague. If you were Moses, what would you do? Eat them up, God. Missed one. Don't forget that one over there. Carol, you're smiling. You have the same spirit I do, don't you? All right. Moses didn't have that kind of spirit. He gets down on his knees and he prays, God, God, have mercy. He gets up, he looks at his brother, he says, go grab your censer and get some fire off the altar and put God's special incense offering on it, that sweet savor to God, and run to where there's a problem. Run to where God's judgment is at work. You're the only one who can do it. If you don't, no one will. Aaron has a choice at that moment. You ever think about that? What if he said no? Praise God, he didn't. But by the time he gets there and stands between the living and the dead, 14,700 are dead. But here's a group of people who can see, but it doesn't compute. Having eyes to see, they don't see. Having ears to hear, they don't hear. That's what the rebel is. Now, on the flip side, let's look at the pathway of submission very quickly. What does the pathway of submission look like? Well, we see, look at verse 4. When Moses heard this, he did what? 16, verse 4. When Moses heard this, he fell on his face before God. Verse 22, he falls on his face. Verse 44, he falls on his face. In fact, when the spies come back from Canaan, they give their report, and everybody turns against them and say, let's stone them with stones. What does Moses and Aaron do? Fall on their face. Fall on their face. If you want to be submissive, you know where the place to learn submission is? On your face. On your face. On your face. You want to be a leader in God's economy? Where do you spend your time? On your face. On your face. Repeatedly, frequently falling on our face before God. God, you're God, I'm not. God, I'd love to see these people consumed, but you wouldn't. God, let me have your heart. God, be who you've said you're going to be for these people. Number two, going to the place that one is sent. Moses says, listen, look at verse 25. You say that I've taken this to myself. I've taken nothing to myself. Number 16, verse 25. Moses ran and went to Dathan and Abiram. He goes there because God told him, and then he starts telling people, look out, God's work is coming. Verse 28, hereby you shall know that it's the Lord who sent me to do this work. I've done nothing of this by my own will, by my own accord. This wasn't my idea. God sent me to do this. I didn't choose this. I think probably the biggest thing about going to the place where one is sent, Moses tells Aaron, hey, Aaron, go to where the plague is. And Aaron just goes. Why? Because he has this pattern. Now, it's an imperfect pattern, to be sure, but there's a pattern. You do what God says to do. You go where God says to go. That's what submission looks like. Because if I don't do it, it's the opposite of submission. It's rebellion. It's speaking God's warning to those in danger. God says, tell them to get away. If they don't, they're going to be swallowed. What would happen if Moses didn't tell them? They wouldn't get away and they would be swallowed. Moses had to do what God told him to do. That's submission. That's just what it looks like. But guess what? It's not just what it looks like for Moses. It's what it looks like for us as well. You have to warn those who are in danger, separating from sinners in their ways. So, not just Moses and Aaron are submissive in this. Moses goes and says, hey, if you don't want to get swallowed, get away. What do? They get away. They get away. They separate from sinners who are on their way to destruction. That's not a very fun part sometimes of submission. It means people that you love, people that you love. In fact, we're going to see in just a little bit that in Numbers chapter 26, verse 11, when recounting all of the names that are going into the promised land, it says, now the sons of Korah did not die. Well, if everything with Korah was swallowed up, what does that say about the sons of Korah? They got away, right? Even though Korah and his family were swallowed alive and 250 of his followers were burned up by fire from the Lord, not all of Korah's descendants perished. The only explanation for this phenomenon is that some of Korah's family broke out of their natural covenant loyalty to father and mother and crossed over to the other side. They joined the rest of the community in leaving the tents of Korah. There's another person that really doesn't stand out here, but look back at verse 1. Now Korah rose up, or took, and so did Dathan and Abiram and who else? Off. I'm kidding, his name's On. Okay. On. Well, we're not told that An is swallowed up. An has been given one day to think about things and stand in front of God, enter God's presence like a priest, like you say you want to be. Apparently, An thought about it and decided to change his mind. He's like that brother that Jesus says, now which one did the right thing? The one who said no and then ends up doing it? Or the one who says sure and then ends up not doing it? Of course, it's the one who said no, but later I'll do it. Okay? It seems as though An separated from sinners in their way. And because he did, in his submission, he's spared and he moves forward. Submission looks like waiting for God to work. Korah comes with this accusation against Moses. Moses says, okay, tomorrow God's going to show who's holy, which one belongs to him. Which is the chosen one? Boy, if you're Aaron, what are you thinking? This is my cousin Korah. He's got a lot more personality than I do. This Korah's got something going for him. I wonder if God's going to choose me. What? He's got to wait. What's God going to do? He doesn't know. He's not been told. He doesn't have the inside scoop. He's got to wait till tomorrow like everybody else. But you know what he's willing to do? He's willing to wait. That's not a fun part of it. Again, being submissive, I want what I want right now so that I can be sure I'm safe. I'm sure I'm secure. Chapter 17 is an important chapter. We didn't get to it. But God is going to say, bring all of the tribal leaders, of all the staffs, of all the tribal leaders, and bring them and set them before me. And I will cause to bud, I will bring to life the one through whom I will bring life to my community. And as God chooses Aaron's rod, we see that the pathway of submission, when we put ourselves in God's ordered economy, when I put myself under, for Aaron, it was under his little brother. Talk about humbling. But when I put myself under God's ordered economy, only then does life flow to the community. When I don't, what do I bring? When Korah didn't put himself into that ordered economy, what did he bring to everybody who followed him? He brought death. He brought death. You understand that what you choose, either as a submitter or a rebel, will affect other people in your life. You will either bring life to others, or the only thing else that you can bring is death. For the way of the submitter, it brings life. Number four, the profile. So what happens? What does life look like if I submit to God? Okay, here's the exciting part of the story. Here's what your life gets to look like if you choose to submit. You will be surrounded by those who refuse to submit. Woohoo! Exciting stuff. Moses, Aaron, they're doing the right thing. They're going the right way. And everybody turns against them. Guess what? When you're going the right direction, please, Peter says, don't find it an amazing thing, because it's not. When the whole world turns against you, what did Jesus tell his disciples? If they love me, they'll love you. If they hate me, they'll hate you. When you side with God, everybody who's not sided with God will not side with you. Get used to it. Get used to it. Here's what your life gets to look like. You'll be accused of promoting your agenda, your glory, not God's. You're just a brown noser. You're just a goody two-shoes. You're just trying to make the rest of us look bad. Is that really what you're trying to do? I'm just trying to do what's right. Yeah, just so you look good, make the rest of us look bad. You know what? People are going to accuse you. Get used to it. You're going to be envied because of unique opportunities. Really? Aaron's the only one who gets to go into this holy of holy. Aaron's the only one who gets to offer a sacrifice. Really? Who's Aaron? Why Aaron? The rest of us are. How come you have it so good? How come you get so lucky? How come your wife is so good? How come your wife is so submissive? How come your wife is so nice? How come you have such a happy family? You really got lucky to have kids that turned out. You get envied. Because you're doing things right, and nobody knows how many times and nights you've spent on your knees in tears, on your face before the Lord, praying for those kids that end up turning out all right. Telling them no and having them mad at you because you didn't give them what they want because it wasn't what they needed at that moment. Envied because you have some unique opportunities. You'll be blamed for a lack of sensational results. I love how he says this one. While Korah assumed that leadership was all about status and privilege, Dathan and Abiram declared it was about power and pragmatic effectiveness. We don't have the goods. We don't have the honey. We don't have the vineyards. We don't have the fields. Pragmatic thinking will often find godly leadership unimpressive. You know what our goal is to build this church? Pray. Tell others about Jesus. Pray. Tell others about Jesus. Do right. Pray. We need to buy ads. We need to get in some drums. We need to add some lights. This isn't the way to build the church. You know what? That's what God's. He's going to build the church. I don't have that responsibility. I don't have that capability. We're just going to stick to what God's told us to do. And God's responsible for the results. Number five, get ready to be accused of disrupting the status quo. You know what you did? You killed the people of the Lord. I was going along, minding my own business. Out of the blue pops Korah. Hey, buddy boy, who do you think you are? Nobody, but apparently God does. He put me here. Okay, let's find out what God says. You're dead. Sorry. Did Moses do anything? But Moses got blamed. You know what? Today, things are worse than they were yesterday, and it's all your fault. Because you did what? Because you just stood with God rather than standing with us. You know, you're holding back the entire United States of America because you don't understand that LGBT, FYZ, H, all the 50 can. Because you don't agree that they should have the same right to marry who they want. It's your fault. You're a hater. Did you do anything? You're just staying where the nation has been, standing on the word of God. Who's changing the ground rules here? But you know what? Get ready to be accused of disrupting the status quo because you choose to submit rather than choosing to rebel. Finally, get ready to be confronted with some poor examples. You're going to have to choose to submit when others around you won't. I think about those sons of Korah. It's their dad. Can you imagine how hard that would be? Dad, I love you. But you're wrong. I'm sorry. Kids, get away from grandpa. You know how hard that would be? But you know what? They were still responsible to do it. Sometimes we don't have good examples. So does that mean that we don't have to submit? That's not what that means. Okay, so what do we do with all of this? This can't just be a moral do better at submitting. That's not the point here. Why should I submit? Very quickly, and we're done. We have to submit because God is good. Korah, all of the others, they've seen over the course of a year and a half, God turn the world upside down, defeat the greatest world power of that day, wash them away in the Red Sea, pushing back the waters some probably 1,000 feet high on either side so they can walk through on dry ground. They've seen God provide for them manna in the wilderness. They've seen God allow their dinky little army to defeat the Amalekites that came up from behind and started to fight against them. They've seen God do so many different things for them. They've seen him come down off the mount to reside in their presence. God who wants to be with them. God who's given them a priesthood to wash away their sinfulness. A God who's taken the time to teach them what holiness means because he wants them to come into his presence. Why trust this God? Because he's good. He's the one who has given you life. Why trust this God? Because he's glorious. I love it. This is going to happen. And all of a sudden the camera pans off scene. And there's the glory of the Lord. Dun, 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 dun. God's glorious. And when God shows up on the scene, everything changes. We live with God's glory in view. Mike was talking about it this morning. One day, everything's going to be right. That day is not today. It's just not. But that doesn't mean that day isn't coming. We must submit. Because our God is glorious. He is beautiful. Our God is righteous. It's an important word in what we looked at in Psalm chapter 5. We're going to look at it again this afternoon. Our God is righteous. He can only do what is right. He can only do what is right. That's who he is. So even though you don't think it looks right from your perspective, whose perspective might be wrong, yours or God's? Just maybe. Right? You don't get to see the big picture. But everything God does is always right. Therefore, I've got to trust him. I've got no other choice. God is just. You got some situation in your life where you've been passed over, you've been accused unjustly. Does God see? Does God know? Does God care? The answer to all of those is yes. And he will not let injustice reign forever. Why? Because God is. God's in control. God's merciful. Now, you've probably, like I have, rebelled in the past. Does that mean you are bound to rebel forever? You don't have to. It's called repenting, turning, going the other direction. That's why Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, Paul said, of whom I'm the chief. But it's a work that God has to do in our hearts. Why submit? Because God made you. And if you've trusted Jesus Christ as your Savior, he owns you. That's a pretty good reason to submit. I was flipping through some papers this week of a seminary chapel. And the guy was trying to get us to understand that we don't own ourselves. He says, what do you want to do with your life? It's a bad question. It's a dumb question. It doesn't matter. The question is, what does God want to do with your life? Because you don't own your life anymore. You gave that up when you became God's. You gave that up when you asked him to be your Lord. It's like trying to take the same $5 bill and trying to spend it twice. Once it's gone, it's gone. Your life is the $5 bill. Either you spend it or God gets to spend it, but you can't both spend it. God gets to spend it. He owns you. He made you. He designed you. He knows what he made you for. Don't you think you should trust him in that? Finally, you should trust God. You should submit to God. Because at the end of the day, who's in control? God. Who found that out in this story? Korah, Dathan, Abiram, Moses, Aaron, Korah's sons, congregation. At the end of the day, wouldn't it be better to play with the winning team than to play on the losing side, knowing you're going to lose? This is a big deal. Men of God and women of God must be characterized, must be defined by submission. Giving control of my life to God and then leaving the results to him. This isn't something that we do well. If you're wearing skin today, this isn't something that you do well. But it's something we need to do, and we can only do because of who our God is. We're submitting to a person who loves us and gave his son for us.